The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, episode 608 for Sunday, June 5th, 2016.
Folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, we answer your questions. We have a community of people that sends in all kinds of great tips. We share those tips. Also, cool stuff found. The goal is for all of us, me included, to learn at least three new things each time we get together. And that, folks, is weekly. We have a couple of sponsors. Actually, we have three sponsors for this episode. One of them is brand new. Atlassian, the makers of Bitbucket, Jira, Confluence, and HipChat. We'll talk more about that later. Atlassian, Atlassian.com. PDF Pen 8 from Smile at smilesoftware.com/geek. Some very cool stuff, including digital signatures and audio notes. We'll talk more about that. And Casper at casper.com/MGG, where coupon code MGG saves you $50 off of, frankly, the best mattress I've ever experienced. So we'll talk more about all three of those shortly here. And here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
Mr. Braun, are you having a rainy morning there in Fairfield?
It's coming. We have according to my weather widget here, which is Weatherman Light, we have a hazardous weather outlook for later in the day. Heavy rain, thunderstorms, and possible flooding. Not as bad as Texas and our one of our friends down there.
Yeah, no, many of our friends down there, in fact. Yeah.
Yeah. Man, what did they do to deserve that?
And we had it here. You know, it's interesting that they had, you know, the worst flooding on record, like 2 years in a row. And we had that here about, I want to say 9-10 years ago. We had, you know, 100-year floods 2 years in a row that are supposed to only come once every 100 years. So I guess we just got it on the cusp in between, right? The 100-year gap starts right between those two. It's weather patterns. It's I guess El Nino year, which is what's affecting Texas this year. Talk to me about this Weatherman Light thing, John. Is it, it's a widget, or it sits in your menu bar, or it's both, or what?
I think I got it from the App Store. It's a free version. I think there's a paid version, but, but yes, it sits in the, it's in the menu bar. So I have the choice I have here is it shows an icon with the weather. So right now it shows a little cloud, and then it shows a little triangular warning sign, which means, oh, I have a warning, you know, issued by NOAA, I believe. And something I've been using for a while, because the last thing I used, they stopped updating it, and it wasn't. If you recall, actually, one of our listeners actually wrote it or did a version of it.
Cool.
No, we'll link to it. Yeah, I mean, the price is right, but it's showing temperature, humidity, all the current conditions. You know, you give it your
code, cool.
And
people in the reviews in the App Store, and there aren't many, but people either absolutely love it or absolutely hate it. So I guess it's one of those things that it either displays the information you want the way you want it, or it doesn't. Sort of like I don't know, lots of things in life, I suppose. So. The good news is, like you said, it's free, and you can test it. And if you don't like it, you can use something else. A reminder, I know you've all, at least from what you've been telling us, you've been voting early and often, but I want to remind you, Podcast Awards voting goes for another week. So go to podcastawards.com, vote for your favorite shows. Mac Geek Gab is listed there in the technology category, so we would love to have you vote for us there. You can vote once per day, so do not forget, please, because it's good to get recognition, and you folks are helping us do that, and we really appreciate it. I think it's time. We had some good comments from last week's episode. So let's see what Everett had to say, if I can find it here.
Hi, John. Hi, Dave. Just wanted to let you know that in your most recent episode, you had a person with Adam's mysterious ghost calls. I'm thinking because there is no voicemail, then it must be a FaceTime call. So that might narrow it down a little bit, because when you make a FaceTime call, at the end of it, it asks you, would you like to send a voice message or would you like to end the call? It does not let you leave a voicemail in the traditional fashion. Anyhoot, hope that helps. Have a good one.
Thanks, Everett. Yeah, you know, that's a good explanation, because without it automatically leaving a voicemail, well, you then wouldn't get one if it were a phantom call or ghost call or a butt dial or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, good thinking, man. I like it. What do you think, John?
I think, did you see our pal Dr. Bob actually scripted something talking about how to deal with this? I'll take up the article.
Okay. Was it any good tip to share?
I think the general tip was lock your phone.
Oh, lock your phone before you put it in your pocket. Yeah, okay.
Right, that'll prevent all sorts of tragedies.
It will, and it'll keep your battery from being burned down unnecessarily, too. So, yeah, cool. Bill had a thought about our discussion about the Apple Watch and the updates last week. He said, Dave's answer about deleting apps was correct, but incomplete. Yes, you can delete apps and also avoid installing them at all by turning off the automatic update. And yes, it's hard to know if a new app has a watch version if auto install is off. So you might want to leave it on. But be aware that a new version of an existing app counts as a new app that will be automatically installed. So if you delete an app, it will reappear when the developer updates it as long as auto update is enabled. There's no way to keep a clean slate. So basically, the choice is between neatness and app discovery. My approach has been to keep auto update on, check the edges of the app screen occasionally for new ones, and use glances and complications to access the apps I use often. All the best. Thanks, Bill. You're highlighting exactly the problem, and thank you for the clarification, Bill. This is the issue with watch apps, is you don't know when a new one has been put on your watch. I wish I could subscribe to a notification or just something to see, oh yeah, whoa. I mean, I know when I download an app, it says this has an Apple Watch app, which is great, but you know, I'm not always thinking about, let me go check the watch app immediately. And then I lose track of the fact that it has an Apple Watch app. So yeah, we got to figure that out. Or Apple does. I mean, there's nothing for us to figure out, but Apple's got to figure it out. I don't know. I got nothing on this. Any thoughts on it, John?
I don't have a watch, so I got nothing either.
Yeah, there you go. All right, let's. Tim has a thought. He says, "I wanted to chime in about the photo stream discussion you guys had in episode 607. I was talking about, just as sort of to couch this, that on my iOS devices, I see that PhotoStream says it has 1,000 photos in it, whereas on my Macs, it's always less than 1,000 and always different on each Mac, sometimes by a little, sometimes by a lot. Tim continues, while the PhotoStream issue described by Dave is certainly frustrating, I think it's actually expected behavior. I happily use iCloud Photo Library now, but I used to rely on PhotoStream to sync photos from my iOS devices to my Mac. From my experience, it's normal to see different numbers of photos in the PhotoStream folders on different devices. PhotoStream stores and syncs photos for 30 days. I don't believe it syncs 1,000 from a device to device. In other words, if you disable PhotoStream on a given device and then re-enable it, I believe the device would only be able to pull down PhotoStream photos from the last 30 days. While the Mac can make permanent copies of PhotoStream photos in the local photos library, PhotoStream on iOS was designed to be temporary. Since I'm now using iCloud Photo Library, I can't test this behavior, but I do recall losing PhotoStream history on devices when enabling disabling it during troubleshooting. Frankly, I always thought that PhotoStream implementation was confusing for users, and I think iCloud Photo Library has been a huge improvement. Here are some relevant bits from the PhotoStream FAQ, and we'll put a link to that in the show notes, but it answers the question, how many photos can my PhotoStream store? And it says, to save storage space, your iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch, keep your most recent 1,000 photos in the My PhotoStream album. And then the second question, can I use my PhotoStream to back up my photos instead of iCloud backup or iTunes? And the answer is no. Photos in my PhotoStream are saved on the iCloud server for 30 days. So thanks, Tim. It's good to know that I don't just have a problem. Like you, I've found PhotoStream mostly helpful but confusing. I do try to plug my phone into my Mac, every couple of weeks. And when I do that, I launch Photos and I tell it to import everything that it does that my Mac doesn't already have. And there's usually something there which tells me that PhotoStream isn't quite doing what I want it to do. But you know, it mostly works, sort of.
Kind of.
Yeah, kind of. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, my solution. But what I do is, I don't rely on PhotoStream for long-term storage. I use it pretty much so I can, if I'm on a different device, I can see a photo that I recently took. But
yes. Yeah. And it usually works for that and usually relatively quickly. There's been times like if I'm doing an article or something and I need to get a screenshot from iOS over. Sometimes PhotoStream does it really, really quickly to my Mac, and other times it's just simpler. The way I do it is because AirDrop is always sort of finicky as well. I message the photo to myself. I don't know if you realize this, but you can use iMessage to send messages to yourself. And that's a really handy way of getting stuff around. I'll be honest. I didn't even think about doing this until I saw my daughter doing it. And she's like, oh yeah, do it all the time. And she's like, it's a great way to just save things or whatever. And it's like, oh yeah. And it works. So I can iMessage it to myself and then it instantly appears, obviously, on all my devices, including my Mac, which is enabled that way. It's good stuff.
Messaging yourself, that's crazy talk.
It does seem like crazy talk, yeah.
No, I get it. And to wrap up, though, what I do to archive my photos is I use Dropbox's camera roll functionality. Mm. Whenever I plug into my computer, it basically scans the phone and says, up, here's some new photos. Let me, I'm going to store them in your Dropbox camera roll for you.
Yeah. All right. Two things. Number one, Alex in the chat room says that AirDrop works well for him. And AirDrop, actually, when I have Wi-Fi on my iMac in the office, it works fine. My problem is I can't AirDrop, and I know there's the hack to make it kind of sort of work over Ethernet, but that I haven't had good experience with that. So I have to turn on Wi-Fi in order to get AirDrop to work. The problem with that is there's no way on the Mac to turn on the Wi-Fi chip without it automatically attaching to a base station, right? And I don't want to have two network connections to my network. And I know the Mac deals with it fine, and I've done it, and I've had it on for days and haven't really had a problem. But just because I'm kind of a geek and don't like to have to deal with, inefficiencies in networks and all of that, I don't like to have two connections to the network. And so that's why I tend not to leave Wi-Fi on. And for those of you that don't know, the way AirDrop works, it does not use your Wi-Fi base stations to communicate. It talks directly between the two devices, so you do not need to be attached to a network in order for AirDrop to work. You just need to have Wi-Fi turned on. So, Terry is asking, photos that are messaged lower resolution than the originals? With screenshots, I have not found that to be the case. But you may be right about that, Terry. So, but with screenshots, it hasn't been an issue for me. I get, full retina size screenshots, which are, of course, notably smaller than pictures. So you might be right. So, yeah. All right. You know, while we're on this subject, John, Anthony had a question this week that sort of triggered something back and forth between you and I. A bit of what I would call a holy grail thing for us. And the question really was, how can I create my own personal photo cloud, right? We have all of these devices. Specifically, he was asking about the Synology. How can I create my own photo cloud? And sort of as a second add-on to that we hear from lots of folks is, how can I create my own photo cloud and still use photos on my Mac as my main library? So this gets interesting. And John, you and I did actually a bunch of experimenting this week and found a couple of things. Where it gets interesting is if you want to continue using photos, obviously the simple solution is just pay the money and store your photos on Apple server and, you know, buy enough storage so that your iCloud photo library can just live there. And then that seems to work really, really well for folks. But that doesn't always make sense, right? If you've already got something like a Synology or really anything, I mean, there's other photo library solutions out there for many different things. How can you create this on your own? And more specifically, how can you get it to read from your photos library? So we experimented this week with PhotoStation on the Synology, which is an interesting piece of software. It is not built to deal with a photos library, though. So I did some digging, and what I found was and we'll sort of save the whether or not you should store your photos library on a NAS question for like the second half of this. But if you have either the original or at least a copy of your photos library on your NAS, you don't want to point your photo station or whatever, you know, photo cloud package you've got at the top level of your photos library. On your Mac, your photos library just looks like a single file, but really it's a package, which means it's a series of folders. So if you sync it over to your NAS is going to see it as it is, as a series of folders. One level deep in your photos library is a folder called Masters. That's the one that you can point your photo cloud solution to. And I did this on my Synology. I pointed PhotoStation to the Masters folder of a test photo library I created, but it worked fine. And the cool part is with PhotoStation is you can set up multiple libraries and you can have them all sort of aggregate together, and each library can have different permissions. So I set the permissions on my photos library to be read only. And this way I'm not having PhotoStation write anything to it and start confusing things, but I still have access to it via the DS Photos app on my phone whenever I want. And it'll actually do some really cool things. It scours the library. It creates thumbnails of its own outside of the library. It'll do some facial recognition. It's a pretty complete package. And then I also do my phone. I have my phone backup to it now. I created a second library that I call my, you know, Dave's iPhone backup. And that one I gave myself write access to. And then I'm able to, you know, and automatically it'll back up my photos from my phone to that. And I've got them stored there. And it notices duplicates. So when it gets those photos from the library, it's not going to show them to me twice in Smart Albums or anything. It's pretty cool. You've messed with PhotoStation as well this week, John. I'm curious as to your thoughts.
So what I did, and actually I think I know the answer to this question here. So what I did, first you and I were discussing, well, can you put a photos library on a NAS? And as far as I can tell, or at least I was successful.
I was too. It was weird. I had a problem with my disk station. I mentioned it actually during the spot that we mentioned for Power Photos last week. And anytime I tried to access a photos library there, I would basically lose access to my entire NAS as a file server from that computer until I rebooted that computer, and then everything was fine. And after you said you were able to use your photos library on your NAS, I thought, okay, well, this is what's different. I thought, well, let me reboot my NAS. And sure enough, everything works fine now. But I don't, I'm torn on this, right? On the one hand, your access to your NAS and the speed that you would get from your NAS would give you faster access to your data than you would get with a locally attached drive, unless it was like a locally attached, really high performance SSD. I am regularly able to soak up a gigabit Ethernet pipe getting data to and from my NAS. So in that sense, I feel like, you know, the NAS is a better place for a photos library. And then you have the redundancy and all of that. There are a couple of things that Apple does in Photos and more so in iPhoto. I feel like the Photos library is a little more robust or less finicky in this regard. But there were some specific things that they did with hard links and aliases or soft links or symbolic links, I should say, that would occasionally get corrupted. I also have been unable to upgrade any library that exists on the NAS. So if you're going certainly from iPhoto to Photos, but even Photos Yosemite to Photos El Capitan, both of those operations had to happen locally. I could not get them to happen on what with the Photos library on the NAS. Yeah. So,
but once it's migrated,
I've had no problems once it's migrated until I need to come back. And that's a lot of data to move around, right? I mean, you're talking about for, you know, our family photo library, it's many hundreds of gigabytes. So now that I've moved that off the NAS to do the upgrade that I mentioned for Lisa last week, I'm hesitant to put it back on there. But what I am doing is I'm carbon copy clonering. Is that the right verb? I guess I'm carbon copy clonering the library. Right now I've got it doing it every day, which is too obsessive. It's too much data to parse through every day, but I'll have it do it once a week over to the NAS so that the data is there and then it's backed up and, you know, all of that and accessible to PhotoStation. So that's my feeling on it. It works and we've been using it for years on the NAS, but every time we have to do something to it, I go through this panic moment of, okay, how am I going to get it off of there reliably without losing data? And it's always a little, you know, it's a little right. something.
So to your question, what I did was not quite what you did. Well, I decided to just, you know what? I'm going to copy my Photos library, the whole file. I'm going to copy it to the photo folder on the Synology. And that's normally where any of their photo apps will start looking. What happens with that, though, is, as you pointed out, Dave, the Photos library is not actually a file. It's a package, and within it is a bunch of folders. And you, of course, pointed out that the Masters folder is the one that you want. Now, in my case, what happened is that I see an album called Photos Library dot photo library, and then within
that's
it
right. yeah.
if I open it, it shows all the enclosed folders. A lot of them have stuff that PhotoStation doesn't know what to do with, but if you open the Masters folder, then it'll start, actually it's sorted by year, or at least in for my setup it's sorted by year, so I see 2011, 2012, 2013, and then, you know, breaks it down by year, by month, and all that. So that was my experience. Now and I think you mentioned to me that if I probably the right thing to do would be when you for it to not show all the folders. I think what you said is that on the Synology, you want to go to, I think, indexing in the control panel, indexing service, media indexing.
No. So PhotoStation is weird. The only thing PhotoStation on the Synology reads is whatever is in your slash photos directory on your Mac, which is weird. Like what it adds to its albums. So you have to do symbolic links on your Synology to any other libraries that you create if you want it to auto import them.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just it. And it even says that, like, if you go if you go to control panel on your Synology indexing service, under media indexing, it says, please note that the only image files, only the image files under the shared folder slash photo will be added to PhotoStation after being indexed. So you can and should add the library manually, but then you have to also do this symbolic link so that it automatically sees it. It's sort of, that's the one bizarre part about this. I'm not sure why.
Yeah. So I think, so what I did is not the correct approach to share your photos library using PhotoStation. Probably a better solution. And I found this because I actually didn't have it installed. So yeah. I installed it, you know, for our listeners and for me. Mm. One thing that was interesting is that apparently it's written in PHP, because when I tried to install PhotoStation, it's like, I need to install PHP.
Yeah.
So I'm going to make a leap here and say that PhotoStation is written in PHP.
Well, it from what I understand, PhotoStation was a third party app that Synology acquired and put into as a, you know, as a native package into their disk station manager, but it's not written by Synology. Many of the other native packages were written in house. PhotoStation was not, which is part of what makes it not quite an equal citizen. And as you said, it's running PHP. So yeah.
Yeah. The one thing that they do offer, which will make your life easier, if you want to use PhotoStation, is that they have a Mac app. It looks a wee bit dated, but it's called, I think it's called PhotoStation Uploader or something similar.
Okay.
Which you can download from Synology. Ah, it's called Synology PhotoStation Uploader. Ta-da!
So maybe this is a better way to do it.
I would say yes. So what it does, it lets you create profiles and it lets you do some other things. But if you create a profile and then you double click on it, it'll launch their app and say, okay, can you give me the source folder of whatever you want to send to the PhotoStation? And the destination folder is hard coded as photo.
Right.
On the disk station. And then it has a few checkboxes here. Upload supported files. Skip files that have been uploaded. That's kind of nice. Uh-huh. Rename files with taken time, which if you... I have that unchecked. Otherwise, it'll use the name of the photo. And then keep the folder structure when uploading. And the last choice is if a folder already exists, rename.
Sure.
Again, it looks like a dated app here.
Okay.
But that's probably the best way for you to interact with PhotoStation from your Mac. And from what I see, there's also a Windows program.
Yeah. So you'd point that at the master's folder of your photos library and then let it kind of just do its thing from there. Is that right?
That, if I had thought about doing that, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, no, that's why
that
we're talking about
correct
this stuff.
Approach.
Yeah.
That
would
have been the correct approach. So because now I have, you know, all this cruft that's in the package as well that shows up in PhotoStation.
Right.
Because I just blasted the library over.
Right.
Yeah, like you said, I mean, I did it over Wi-Fi, and I think it took like 2.5 hours because, like you, I have a huge library. It's like 100 gigs.
So,
it over Wi-Fi. I mean, it what I did works, but it's inelegant. So,
Well,
so if I had to do it again, or if I want to use PhotoStation, I don't know if I'm really committed to it at this point. I use other tools.
But, right. I like the whole private cloud idea. I mean, I have this, you know, and this is, people who have been listening to this show since the inception know that this has been one of those things for me that sort of drove me crazy for a while. It's like, well, we have all these boxes that store things. Why are they not doing smart stuff for us? They're network connected boxes that store things. They have a CPU in them. They run Linux. They all do. You know, what can we have them do? And so this is part of it. It's like, why, I, as I said at the beginning of the discussion, if you don't want the headache, simply pay Apple instead of paying for one of these other boxes, or perhaps in addition to paying for one of these other boxes, but simply pay Apple for storage of your photos and it'll all happen magically and everything's cool. But if you want to do this, which I sort of do because it's like, hey, I already have this box. I'm a geek. I'm willing to inherit some problems. You know, and it's fun, right? Sorting this stuff out. So yeah, cool. All right. Well, we'll keep talking about this. I'm curious if any of you have used anything else to create your own you know, photo cloud. And it could be as simple as, you know, as John said earlier, Dropbox. It could be something like a package like OwnCloud. I think they've got a photos thing in there. And OwnCloud, if you don't know about OwnCloud, this is a cool thing. It's an open source, I believe it's open source, and it's free, engine to host your own stuff. And it's all kinds of stuff. I mean, including like calendars and contacts. I mean, all these servers just sort of wrapped into one, and it's for creating your own personal cloud that's internet accessible. It can be installed on a Mac. The last time I looked, there was some problem, and it might have been like a sandboxing related thing that wasn't letting it happen, but it looked like they were working on that. So it could be OwnCloud, it could be Dropbox, it could be anything. I'm just curious if anyone has rolled their own photo cloud-ish thing, because it's interesting to me, and it seems to be interesting to you. We get a lot of questions about this, so I'm curious to share the hard mind.
Throughout my history of using my computer and the internet and the cloud to manage my photos, the only nice thing about using your Synology and the solution it offers is that you've already paid for it.
That's the thing, right?
You may have to pay for bandwidth depending on who you're using for, to access the internet.
But that's the thing is you're paying for bandwidth more so, I think, with Apple's iCloud photo library, because you have to upload all of your photos to the library. Whereas here, if I'm managing my photos in the house, the bandwidth is happening locally. The only time I'm using bandwidth is if I want to access my photos from remote or do a backup remotely or, something like that.
Right. My only caution, or my only concern with, having someone else do it, number one is that you typically have to pay them. But my reflection is that throughout my career, Dave, I've had two of these cloud services that offered some sort of photo sharing, basically say, okay, stop being a cheapskate. We want to charge you now. And those two were SugarSync and Bitcasa, both of which, as far as
you
I
mean
can tell, they're
SuperSync
still...
SuperSync or SugarSync? Oh, SuperSync, something different. No, sorry. You're right.
SugarSync, was the last one I recall where I had a free plan with them, and all of a sudden they said, well, go away.
Right. No, I remember that. Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, bye.
Yeah,
and
bye.
Bitcasa just did that too, and they both offered some level of, if you stored your photos, they would provide some sort of interface.
Yeah.
That's the only bummer with these free services is that when they stop being free...
it's clear that there is no business model in hosting photos for free in that way. I mean, Yahoo/Flickr is doing it, but they just stopped the whole Flickr uploader thing from Mac for free accounts. And they're also trying to sell the company. So, this clearly not a sustainable thing. And it's why Apple charges for this stuff. I do not fault Apple for doing this. Like I said, it's just more like you just said, it's, we've got these boxes, let's use them. So,
and I've had some, now the most recent one on my radar, and then I think we should move on, is Microsoft.
Mm.
So I use their cloud as well, which is OneDrive. And they recently had a little while ago, a special saying, hey, if you manage your photos with us, no doubt to, draw people into using their ecosystem, they're like, we're going to give you 32 gigs. I'm like, awesome. So I have 32 gigs with them. But then I got an email recently from them saying, by the way, cheapskates, we're going to cut that down to 5 soon.
Yeah.
So,
it's not sustainable by anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. And the one that's been going the longest that still, gives me the space that they originally gave me is Dropbox. And we love those guys. But even they may say, we're going to have to ditch you free people. I hope they don't.
A lot of the Dropbox doesn't offer that much storage, though, for free. For the most part, they're a freemium service too. They're going to give you 5 gigs. You might have like 20 because we have this big listener base. And when Dropbox was a thing, when it was coming up, we had referral codes and that helped. And that, listen, it's great. It worked out for everybody. We all got a little bit of extra, and you and I probably got more extra than than most, because we had more people sign up using our code. But there's a cap to that, right? I'm sure, in fact, I'm certain that I've had far more people than whatever earned me 20 gigs sign up using my code. And they all got their code, and that's where they all got their extra space, and that's great. But Dropbox capped it. And I think it's 20, right? And then you could earn more doing other things. And if you buy an Android phone, you get like 50 gigs free sometimes for 2 years, which I had for a little while. Not that I...
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, so yeah, I've got 25 gigs of Dropbox. So I don't expect that to go away. But that's also not enough for my photos library. I'd need, you know, 10 times that. So, all right. I want to talk about our sponsors, John. There's some cool stuff here. How's that work for you?
Outstanding.
All right. Our first sponsor today is a longtime sponsor of MacGeekab. That's Smile Software with a brand new product, PDF Pen version 8. In case you don't know, PDF Pen is an awesome tool for editing PDFs. First of all, you get to break that whole scan, print, sign, fax cycle and do everything paperless. You can add text and graphics to a PDF, and your signature can stay in a library right in there that you can just drag in. You can also drag in your name if you've got other stuff that you're doing on a regular basis. You can make corrections to a PDF. You can actually edit the text that's right there in the PDF. You can redact sensitive information in a way that actually does it. PDF Pen 8 enhances that even more. Take those signatures. Now you can do it with actual digital signatures. You can now send and receive PDFs in a way that makes everybody comfortable. You can also export to Microsoft Word now without the need for internet access. It does it all within the app. You can access file attachments, and you can make audio notes that you record in place. Very, very cool stuff. They've priced this in a great way. If you have a previous version of PDF Pen, it's just $30 to upgrade to PDF Pen 8. If you have a previous version of PDF Pen, it's just $50 to upgrade to PDF Pen Pro. That's a great deal because it's a great way to get into the Pro product. With that, you can add forms that you create yourself on a PDF. You can create a portfolio to combine them all. You got to check this out. Go to smilesoftware.com/geek and check out PDF Pen 8. Demo it first, and then I'm certain you're going to buy it. It's one of those things I just can't live without. Smile seems to be able to do that. They make software I can't live without. You got to check it out, smilesoftware.com/geek. Our thanks to Smile for sponsoring this episode. Our second sponsor today is Casper. Casper.com/MGG, using coupon code MGG, is where you're going to go to save $50 on arguably the best mattress you've ever experienced in your life. That's certainly true for me. I've said it on the show before, a couple of years before Casper came on board, we needed a new mattress. So we went out, we researched everything. We found the discount place closest to us. We had to test the mattress by laying in the store because that's the previous way of doing it. And frankly, it's the way most people still do it. Not if you work with Casper, though. And we tested it and we bought a mattress from one of these local places. That's actually an awesome mattress. We paid about $1,400 for a king size mattress. The same quality mattress, arguably better quality from Casper. It's a more comfortable mattress that you get from Casper. The price is $950. You'll remember back to the beginning of this spot where I said, you get $50 off though. Go to casper.com/MGG, use coupon code MGG. Now you're paying $900 free shipping and you get to test it out at your house the way you normally sleep, i.e. not in your clothes and for more than 5 minutes at a time. That's the right way to test a mattress. You've got 100 nights from Casper to test out this mattress. If you don't like it, they'll come take it away for free. No cost to you whatsoever. This is the way it's supposed to be. And this isn't just any old mattress. Like I said, when I bought a mattress, I went and researched and I got the best one I could find. Well, Casper's the same way. It's the best one you can find. And like I said, I find it more comfortable than the one that I paid 50% more for. Check it out. Casper.com/MGG, coupon code MGG. Order yourself a mattress. Try it out. Like I said, the most you're going to pay using our coupon code, $900. That's for a king size. If you need a smaller bed because that's what works for you, it's less. Our thanks to Casper for sponsoring this episode. I'm super stoked to bring on our third sponsor for this episode, a new sponsor for Mac Geek Gab. It's Atlassian. That's Atlassian at Atlassian.com. Atlassian is super obsessed with uniting a team in a productive way. And they've got a ton of products. We're going to try and talk about four of them here today. So the first I want to talk about is Bitbucket. Bitbucket allows you to track all the changes that you make to your code. Even if you're just doing a project by yourself, it's good to know what changes you made and when, so that you can say, oh, this bug was introduced. What did I do to cause that? But especially if you're working with a team, really helpful. In fact, mandatory to track your code. That's Bitbucket. Then there's Jira. I've used Bitbucket. I've used Jira. Jira, J-I-R-A, is a tool that allows you to track bugs, track feature requests, manage tasks project-wide. And you can link those to the code in Bitbucket. So you can say, oh, I fixed this bug or added this feature. And they've got a great web interface to manage all of this. Really awesome stuff. Another tool, Confluence, where you can create and share content, organize all the results, and bring the team up to speed. And one last one that I'm almost certain you've heard of, HipChat, allows you instant messaging or video chat with your entire team or a member of your team from any device. You get in the feel for what Atlassian's about. It's teamwork. Atlassian is so focused on teamwork that their stock ticker symbol is TEAM. If that's not a commitment to teamwork, I don't know what is. You got to check this out. Go to Atlassian.com. Check out what they're up to. Start using one of their tools. Even if you're using other stuff, Atlassian will link with just about anything that's out there. They understand that being in a walled garden with all these silos is not helpful. They link with all kinds of stuff from other vendors. Check it out, Atlassian.com. Our thanks to Atlassian for sponsoring this episode. All right, John. It's time for some, it's time for Sean, because Sean says, my wife recently changed her iPhone PIN code and forgot it the next morning. Luckily, she still has access to the phone with her fingerprint with Touch ID. However, should the phone turn off or reboot, she will be required to put in her forgotten code. Sadly, she had not made any backups of her phone on her Mac. I guess you could say she got caught. She probably should listen to this podcast with me. Well, I'll leave that up to you. Her iCloud backups continue to fail, even though she is only trying to save her contacts and has 4.8 gigabytes of available space. Trying to delete the current backup fails as well. This is a sort of known thing we've run into. He says, doing some problem solving, I've managed to get her data off of her phone to my computer using iMazing. Here's my question. If I restore from an iMazing backup, will I still need to enter the forgotten PIN code? And if so, alternatively, if I need to reset to factory, can I add the data back to her phone piecemeal style from the iMazing backup, i.e. just selecting photos, notes, contacts? Will we be forever grateful, or we will be forever grateful if you could shed some light on this? So first of all, this is a great little to sort of tip. If you forget your password, you still have some access to your device. Now, it's not just if her phone turns off that she will need to type the code. There's also new rules about this in one of the iOS 9.x updates, where if you've got it going for too long, I think if it hasn't been unlocked for like 8 hours, you've got to type in your passcode again, right? So, so there's that. However, your iMazing backup is going to work. Even if you restore the whole thing, no, you don't have to enter the passcode. You might, if you saved the backup with its own password, which would be different from your passcode on the device. But if you encrypted the backup, then you will need to know the password for the encrypted backup. But that's something that you would know because you just did the backup. With iMazing, you can restore the whole thing, or as you pointed out, you can restore piecemeal, which is just a cool feature of iMazing and something obviously you can't do with iTunes. Really handy to be able to just restore a piece of data without wiping anything else on your phone. But yeah, you should be fine, but I would do that ASAP because the time will come when your phone or her phone just decides, hey man, you know, it's time. You got to type in your passcode and then it's over. Right, John?
On the one hand, I'd say awesome that you chose a passcode that's so complex that you forgot what it is. On the other hand, it's not great if you want to get back into your phone.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I still personally still use the 4-digit, which some people would shake their fist at me. You can, as some may know, but if you don't, you can make one that is longer than that. And that may or may not be it. Well, it's up to you. The longer, the better. People typically recognize with passwords or pins or whatever, right?
Yeah. And the thing is, I don't use a 4 or a 6-digit passcode, pin code, whatever.
Really?
Yes. I do a custom length passcode. And you can do that when you go into, into settings, and you can go to passcode options, and you can do a 4-digit numeric code. You can do a custom numeric code. Or a custom alphanumeric. And so my custom numeric code is not 4 or 6, because those are obvious options. And I don't want obvious options. I want something that's maybe a little harder to guess. So there you go.
Yeah, look at that. I'm on the change screen.
Yeah.
Custom alphanumeric, mm-hmm. custom numeric, or 4-digit numeric. Huh, maybe I should change that. I just got to think of something clever I won't forget.
That's the key. Yeah. So yeah, that's, it's something, right? I don't know. It's, it's tough. I always say we choose our place on the continuum that exists between being uber secure and being uber open, right? We could all live in homes that had nothing but brick walls. We choose not to, because maybe we want to put a door in so that we can go in or out of our home. And maybe we want to put a window or two in so that we can see in or out of our home. But as soon as we do something for us, well, we're doing that for other people. Right. And so it all comes down to the keys. And part of it is security by obscurity, which works right up until someone knows that they want your data. And then that doesn't work anymore. And that's what you need to protect against, is, deciding where on that continuum you're comfortable living.
Actually what helped me with that, not to go on a tangent, well, maybe a little bit, but what helped me with this, Dave, was one, using a password manager. I'm a LastPass type of guy. I think you're a 1Password type of guy. They're both fine products. LastPass at some point introduced the thing saying, you know what? Let me show you how many of your passwords are the same. And for a while, I would do this.
Or they're like,
let me show you the passwords that you have that are similar or the same. And it gives you a security rating. And I looked and I'm like, wow, I had way more passwords that were a bit too similar than I thought. So let me, and it'll then put you through a mode where you can start changing them. And then it'll, again, give you a percentage score saying, how good of a security implementation you have. So that was something to whip by, and I think 1Password has something similar, right?
Like, yeah,
security audit
thing. They do. Yeah. Okay. I don't like to look at that because it tells me I have all this work to do. Yeah. So that's security by I guess that's the ostrich method, right? And it's like, okay, you're gonna tell me something, so I'm gonna put my head in the sand for a minute and then we're good. But yeah, it's cool the way that it can attempt to auto change passwords. Alex is pointing that out in the chat room at MacGeekab.com/stream.
Yes. But the other thing it helped me do was that for a lot of sites, they use your email address. And the thing is, there's an email address that I wanted to start moving away from. And that was another thing where it was very good to help me do that. I basically searched and it's like, yeah, here are all the sites where your username is your email. Maybe you should change that. And pretty much, there's only one site where it won't let me change it, although it'll let me change the email address that it'll send notifications to, but my account is like hard coded to that email address. But like I said, it's not the end of the world, because in my profile, I can put a different email address for ongoing communications.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I like this. Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. These password managers, I've mentioned, not only do I use 1Password, but I also use iCloud Keychain. And they actually work very well together. And the nice part is when I'm on my iOS device, not only does it just have my passwords right in my browser without having to use the, you know, the little plugin and that's sort of, you know, an extra four steps. But if I change a password, it remembers it without me having to go through the extra four steps. It'll just say, hey, this is a new password for you. Should I update your iCloud keychain? And I say, yeah. And then when I go to log into that site on my Mac, 1Password sees that I'm logging in with a different password because iCloud keychain populates it and says, hey, do you want me to update to match this? So it's almost automatic that the two sort of, you know, manage to keep each other up to date without me having to do anything. And it's really handy. I've been very happy. I kind of started doing it as a stopgap measure to make sure that, you know, I didn't miss anything. And it's been this way for years and it works really, really well. Despite it sounding very kludgy and clunky, it's not. It's a pretty smooth experience. And then the nice part is, even though I'm primarily using iCloud Keychain as my sort of main password system, if I have a website where there's multiple things to log into, 1Password is much better at that, you know, just their UI for choosing the other passwords for, to me, is much better. And it's also much better if I need to look up a password at some point, you know, either on my Mac or especially on my iOS device. 1Password's interface and the way you can search and see things and store extra data is just, I mean, it's much better. So I will happily pay for that to have that extra functionality. And then iCloud Keychain just sort of keeps it all smooth, especially with my iOS devices. So I highly recommend using iCloud Keychain, Mr. John F. Braun.
Hmm.
What you have now? Do you have something against iCloud Keychain other than just adding a layer of confusion that I just discussed?
Apple has burned me in the past with their keychain solutions, so I'm wary.
But I mean, and that's me too, right? Same, and that's why one of the reasons I did not give up on 1Password initially. As I said, now it's a very smooth process for me. But initially it was like, yeah, I'm not going to store all my stuff there and then get burned again. But it, in terms of just the convenience factor of it, it's killer because it, especially on iOS, it's all just right there. Just pretty good.
The thing is, I did recently have to enable it, Dave.
Yep.
But I'm not enabling it for day-to-day use. So maybe I will, but the thing is you and I were talking about HomeKit, and there was actually a utility that I downloaded on my phone to see if another device that I have, which I'll talk about at some point in the future, but it's going to have HomeKit compatibility. And when I ran this one app, it said, yeah, I'm going to need you to turn on iCloud Keychain.
Right.
Because I need it. And I think that's a HomeKit requirement for password management.
I believe it. Yeah.
So other than that, I wouldn't have turned it on. So I have it turned on one device.
Okay. Okay.
Because HomeKit.
Because of HomeKit. Yeah. No, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Sadly, the device will not have HomeKit compatibility until sometime next year. But, you know, we're going to some shows soon. So maybe I'll get something HomeKit. Or I'll set up, what is it, Homebridge?
Yeah.
Supposedly, there's a plug-in for the Wink system that I have, which okay. I use to control yep. my light bulbs. So I may go through the effort of setting that up. There's a bit of effort. It's not just...
Yeah.
You don't just snap your fingers and install it. It's compiling it or installing it, and then you got to configure the plug-in, and you got to get these passwords and UUIDs and all this
stuff. Homebridge is cool. I'm running it on my Synology. And it's interesting. So but you can run it on your Mac, and it's arguably
it's on
easier.
Synology. So yeah. I can install the package on.
You can install it inside a Docker on Synology. That's the best way to do it. It's not unique to Synology. It's a way of installing containers. So it will have an entire OS. It's almost like a virtual environment. But not quite virtualized in the way that we would normally think of these things. But essentially that's what it is. It creates a shell. And then you can have whatever OS running inside it that you want. And that OS can then run whatever app you want. So a lot of people are doing that with CrashPlan now, because it's easier to do it inside Docker than it is, you know, the other way in terms of keeping it updated and all of that. But so, yeah, you can put Homebridge inside a Docker container on your Synology, but you can also run it on your Mac. And it, frankly, from what I hear, people have more success just running it straight on a Mac that's, you know, always on. But essentially what Homebridge does, we've talked about it before, but what it does is it creates a pipe to, or bridge, hence the name, between HomeKit, AKA, you know, Siri control, and all of your non-HomeKit devices. And it's like John was saying, it's got plugins available for all kinds of things, and you have to know what you're going to use. And like John said, you've got, you know, sometimes the configuration files need to be a little bit, you know, pedantically built. But once you get it built, it's cool. And then you can use any HomeKit app you want. I like the Elgato Eve app, and you don't need to have any Eve hardware to use it. And it works really, really well when Homebridge is running. And that's my only problem is with the way I had it in the Docker at first, it was like, it was a little bit of a headache just to keep it running. And I don't know why, but again, that's why people that run it on their Macs don't have that problem. So yeah, Homebridge is cool. It's, cause it's that bridge between all these, you know, quote unquote smart home devices that you might have that don't have HomeKit support. So you can't use them with HomeKit. And now you can. And that includes like Sonos and all kinds of things. My Harmony remote for the TV, none of those things are HomeKit compatible. And yet Homebridge has plugins and they just work. It's cool. So I can say, you know, dinner and a movie. And then it turns off the Sonos. It turns on the TV to the, you know, to the Apple TV. And you could even have it dim your lights and whatever you want to do. It's cool. I don't know. Sort of. We'll get there. It's fun. Where are we going to go now, John? We've had all kinds of great little tangents, but I like them. It's good. It's keeps things interesting. Where are we here? We talked about that. This is one of my favorite things this time of year to talk about. So I want to go to Bob, John, because, this is, we always have a question like this, and every year there's more data. So, Bob writes, I recently moved into a new house that has a large shop building about 180 feet away. The shop has a metal roof and skeleton with wood siding. It's just past the range of the Airport Extreme 5 that is in my house. I'd planned to use Powerline Ethernet to provide network connectivity to the shop, but existing Enphase solar panel microinverters already use that to communicate with the internet. Since two Powerline Ethernet systems on one service feed may cause mutual interference, I have no LAN or internet in my shop. What LAN/Wi-Fi extension methods can you recommend? Is it not reasonable to install a hardwired it is not reasonable to install a hardwired Ethernet connection to the shop, as it would require trenching under an asphalt driveway. Have Wi-Fi extenders gotten good enough to work well in cases such as this? Do you think a higher powered Wi-Fi transmitter in my house might do the trick, or will I need a microwave link or something else entirely? All right, so I love these questions, and they, every year they start to crop up right about this time. As people in the, you know, Northern Hemisphere, start thinking about, you know, stuff that we can do outside to improve our lives. And then, you know, we batten down again for the winter. For those of you that haven't been in like New England, where John and I are, in the summertime, it's construction everywhere, because it's like, we got to get it done now, because in the winter, we certainly don't want to be doing any constructing. So this is right along those lines. There's a couple of things. So first of all, I have almost exactly this setup. I do have Ethernet running underground. It doesn't run through the driveway. It actually runs sort of around the edge of the driveway. But obviously that's great. But when I got these Eero's set up, I set up the Eero, and sure enough, it was able to get a connection to itself. So I put one unit in the office, and I actually put one unit at the back of the office. So I clear on the other side of the office from that, which faces the house. I put one there and then one in the house, and they got a connection, and it's a solid connection. So It's certainly not the way Eero is built to be used, but it's solving the problem that Eero purports to solve, which is just don't have to think about it. Just put them in. And it's been reliable and rock solid, and it works for, you know, a week. So it's good. It's good. That might be a solution for you. Or you might want to do something else. And this is where it starts to get geeky, but fun. We just had, just recently had a listener tell us about the Ubiquiti Networks Air Fiber 5s. Now, these things are not cheap. They're about $1,000 a piece, I think. And I don't think you need exactly this, and I'll tell you why. Your distance is a little shorter than what our listener is doing. But these Ubiquiti devices, he has two of them set up 3.2 miles apart. Yes, miles. One at his house, one at his friend's house. Line of sight, they aim them at each other, they sync up, and they create essentially a LAN bridge. He's getting 1.2 gigabits per second throughput out of them. Let that sink in for a second. That's faster than the Ethernet line I have going between my house and my office. It's faster than any Ethernet line I have anywhere here, even going between two computers that are right next to each other. 1.2 gigabits, 3.2 miles. That's pretty good. I'm not sure I'd want to be standing in between those things while they're operating.
That was my thought. Yeah, I think it may get warm if you're in the path of that.
Yeah, but if you need to fry an egg, man, you know, just pass right through. You're good to go. So that is one option. And you don't need, obviously, you don't need something that can go miles and miles. You don't need something that can go 1.2 gigabits per second either. You can find these things. It's all about an antenna and the right router. Now, I have a cheap uncle. And he does this. He has a similar scenario. I think I've mentioned him a couple of years in a row here because he's sort of the perfect use case for this. He's got two houses in Maine and there's a road in between them. And we've talked about this. He might be able to, you know, schmooze the town council because his other brother is on the council to let him dig up the road. But he's not interested in that because that would cost him more than the solution that he's done. He's running a pair of old, really old D-Link DWL 2200 AP routers with their stock firmware in WDS plus access point mode. He says, I chose those because they had the highest wireless power output and they were cheap. Most routers don't tell you the power. Well, the other thing that he doesn't mention, but sort of goes without saying, but needs to be said, is they also have external antenna connectors. He says, for the antennas, I don't recall the brand. He says, but I think it's the Radiolab's 2.4 gigahertz Backfire 1.4. He says, I've got a pair of those 15 dB gain passive dishes. They look like small metal garbage can lids. Again, these didn't cost very much. I chose 15 dB gain because higher gain is a tighter beam. That's harder to aim. I don't need that headache. Other people have used old satellite dishes picked up at the dump. He says, there must be instructions on the web. So, and he's getting, I would say 20, 30 megabits per second out of those things. And these are old routers that, you know, don't have all the latest stuff. So the right antenna, even with a cheap, cheap router, you could build a microwave dish setup kind of thing that reliably gets your data across. The thing you need to worry about, my uncle's been through this too, because sometimes trees tend to grow between him between his two homes there. And it's actually his home and his daughter's home. And the whole reason he's doing this is because he doesn't want to pay for internet service in both houses. You know, so like I said, he's my cheap uncle. He's frugal. I don't want to say he's cheap. He's actually a very generous guy. He's done well for himself, but he's frugal and it's great. Occasionally he has to go and cut a tree down and so that line of sight beam is intact because as soon as you break that line of sight, the connection is gone. It's not like the Wi-Fi we have in our homes where it's just broadcasting in a, you know, very widespread and it sort of bounces around things and it's all good. This is a beam. And if you break the beam, you do not get connection. So just something to bear in mind. Anyway, this is that's my thoughts on this stuff. Like I said, I love this, even though I don't have to do it here. I love it. And I love that one of our listeners, I think it was Everett, actually, who had a comment earlier in the show, is getting 1.2 gigabits over 3 miles. It's crazy, man. Any thoughts, John?
Well, yeah, but you said they're like $1,000, right?
Yeah, but you don't
that
need
money. I'd expect to get some.
Well,
some,
right, but it, the speed. Fact that it's doable is you know is really kind of what I'm trying to convey. And ubiquity, it's the good news is ubiquity is more and more getting into the consumer space with stuff like this. So, and they do, they have things that are much less powerful and therefore much less expensive. So I think for a few $100, you could probably do what you need to do with stuff from ubiquity. Or, like I said, Eero might just solve this problem without you even having to think about it. And that's even better. It depends on, I have no doubt that Eero would do it. The question is, would it be enough bandwidth for you? Because they're using, you know, they're not using focused antennas, but they are doing very smart things with beamforming and all of that between the sort of back channel radios that happen on the Eero. And it just solves the problem where you don't have to think about it. So,
yeah. No, it is cool because I've seen, you know, either microwave antennas or dishes mostly in commercial installations, or
yeah.
At least I know that that's what they are, though. You typically have to be a business or satellite dishes. I've seen like some of the gas stations around here, I guess they have a fairly real time connection to their back end. Through
yeah.
A satellite.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Satellite is the champ as far as speed is concerned, though. I know.
Well, certainly not latency. Listeners. Yeah.
Yeah. I know a few of our listeners. The ping isn't that great.
No, it's like 1 second. So yeah, it's not good.
I've got to look at I got to look at different antennas here. Cause that's, it's all about the power and all about the antennas.
Yeah.
When you're talking, RF throughput and, I should look here on my TP-Link. I played around with, putting different antennas on a past base station.
Yeah.
And, depending on what you get, it couldn't, if you get better gain and, it's tuned properly, you get more oomph.
So. Yeah. But you're right. It's not just about the antenna. It's about making sure the radio is tuned to the antenna properly. Otherwise you could actually make it worse. You will for certain be able to change it. The question is, will you be changing it for the better? So, yeah. See, it's fun. I think it's cool. We actually had a request for this one, John. So I think we'll honor the request today since we're in tangent mode anyway. But this one was on the list. We had a request to do a segment, and I feel like this is going to be an ongoing segment because I want your input on it too, that essentially is the expert's guide to getting help at the Genius Bar. And there's all the sort of general tips of, make sure you back up your Mac before you go in and, act polite because that's what you learned in kindergarten and all that good stuff and schedule an appointment. Then that's good advice. Don't get me wrong. And we will still cover that. But I want to talk about the things that we geeks do when we go in there. Sometime these aren't things Apple would advise you to do. In fact, I'd love to hear from and you can, as always, do so anonymously. But I'd love to hear from active or even past geniuses about some of these things and perhaps your other thoughts. I'll start with a few of these, John. And then if more come to mind from you, chime in. And obviously you folks that are out there also doing this, please chime in and we'll share it because it's the hive mind that is Mac Geekab. That's what we do. Before going in with a problem, I always try a full restore. This is true for Mac or iOS before going to the Genius Bar, because that will be one of their steps. And my goal in going in is to shortcut to solution, right? I don't want to have to let them do all the troubleshooting. And that's sort of the gist of this is convincing them to skip some of their own troubleshooting steps to get to solution faster. They want to get to solution faster, but they have to do it in a way where they're comfortable with what's happened. And you can sort of massage this, but you have to do it in the right way. So I do a full restore before going in and I test after that, because that's the first thing they're going to say is, well, it might be a software problem. And they're not wrong. Oftentimes you go in and you're like, I know it's my graphics card, right? And like, okay, but we have to rule out a software problem. So I always do a full restore, or I go in and am willing to tell them that I've done a full restore. And I wait until we get to the point where they say, well, the next thing we have to do is a full restore, you know, after I explain the problem and we go through all that. And I say, oh, no, good news. I've already tried that. And if you've prepared the Genius up to that point by showing them you're collected, focused, you know what you're doing, they will believe you. Now, you may be lying to them. I have done that. I've gone in. They've said full restore. I'm like, no, I've already done it. Oh, okay. And if they trust me at that point, then they'll skip to the next step. Now, you got to be ready to be right about that, because if you're wrong about it, now the Genius isn't going to trust you at all. Rightly so. So you have to be careful when you play that card, especially if it's a card that you don't actually have in your deck. The other thing I do is I set up. Well, do you have any thoughts on that before we? Yeah.
Okay. Well, I want you to be clear. So with iOS, I think what you're saying by doing a restore is when you have your device plugged in, there's a restore button that'll restore it either to factory configuration or restore from a backup.
Well, it'll restore it to factory, and we're talking about a button in iTunes, but yeah, it'll restore it to factory configuration. And then when it comes back up, it offers to restore it from a backup.
Right.
And you can
be clear on that now. Yep. Okay. Now with a Mac though, I mean, there is, and maybe that's where you're going with the Mac, there's no restore in iTunes.
No, you've got to
do
there
is
clean.
Well, there is the recovery partition.
That's exactly right.
Okay, which is a place you may want to go. When things go bad with your main Mac installation, going into recovery, which you typically achieve by holding down Command-R when you boot, and if everything is set up right, you should go into something called recovery, and it'll let you run a few different things.
Yeah.
You know, disk first aid and some other things.
Yeah. And I know, and we go through a lot of that. Often, I don't want to get too pedantic. Okay. I mean, pedantic's the wrong word. I don't want to get too basic with this particular advice. But you're right. That's the way to do it. And to sort of finish that circle, you can do that on the Mac to a different drive too, right? You know, so you're not forced to wipe your drive or anything like that. Yeah, but you want to be you definitely want to either have tested that or be really certain on your own that it is not necessary to test that way. But the only way to communicate that to the Genius is to say, I've already tested that way. That is the, and this really helps when you're on the phone, because it can save you a ton of time and save them a ton of time. But again, you've got to know that you're right about this. The second thing that I do is I set up a test account with admin privileges and test your problem with it beforehand, but also allow the Genius to do that. Because if you go in, and this is specific to the Mac, but if you go in and they launch into your normal user account and make it, you know, start seeing all your crazy stuff loading. If there's more than like two things in the menu bar, every Genius I've encountered says you have too many things running in your menu bar. It's like, well, that's not true. You know, maybe it's true for your personal preference, but there's no rule of the universe that says by having extra things in your menu bar, your Mac won't behave properly. It might not. But again, you've probably set up your Mac in a way that you're comfortable with the way that it works. And these extra things aren't the problem. But it's good, A, to test that on your own by setting up a test user account, and B, show that test user account to the Genius to avoid that conversation all together. That's been a handy thing for me. You want to pave a path for the Genius that avoids any questions or tests that you have already ruled out. Right? I think.
Indeed.
Yeah. You know, and I guess that's the sort of the gist behind this, and I'd love to hear more tips about it. But you know, it's do your research and be ready to politely interrupt the Genius's process by offering to make it more efficient for them, right? Acknowledge your respect for the process, but use your technical acumen and your social engineering skills to convince the Genius that they can shortcut past a couple of steps or just avoid them altogether. That's, I don't know. So I'd love to hear more. about if anybody has any good Genius Bar tips, this would be it would be a great thing, because at some point, all of us, it doesn't matter how good you are, sometimes the Genius Bar is what you need, and they're the right ones to solve or at least diagnose a problem for you. So, because they have access to hardware that we don't typically have access to or can get much cheaper. You know, I'll point out, what was it, about a year and a half ago, I had that issue with my power supply. Well, turned out to be my graphics card, but they started with the power supply in my iMac, in fact, in the one that's right in front of me. For them to replace the power supply, including all the labor to get in and out and the part, was $66. To get the part alone from, I think, iFixit or really anywhere, was more than that. It was like $75. So a lot of times, unless you want to dig into your iMac, and don't get me wrong, that can be fun. But if you're looking to do it the most economical way, a lot of times the Genius Bar is that. If your machine is new enough to be serviced by the Genius Bar, and they do have a cutoff on that. So I don't know. Anything else on this one, John?
One that I went there. So the last time I was at the Genius Bar, it was a battery problem. So this may sound obvious, but make sure that the problem that you're having is reproducible. There's nothing more embarrassing than saying, the thing is, so what I had is when my phone reached 20%, it would power down. I'm like, so what I did is, number one, I made sure that this was consistently happening, and it was. And then number two, I powered it up to like 25% and then went to the Genius Bar and I started depleting it. And right around my appointment time, I said, okay, watch this. And it happened. So that there was no denying, because sometimes tech support people, rightfully so in some cases, may not entirely trust your perception of...
they can't.
What happened?
We have to, in troubleshooting someone's scenario, we have to assume that the customer is lying. And I don't mean that in a malicious way. No, it's just usually the reason someone asks for help is they don't know the answer. And I used to love it when somebody would call me on the phone and say, I need you to come out, but this is going to be really quick. Like, are you seriously? Like, you call me and you want me to do something, and now you're telling me exactly what the solution is that you called me to figure out. I get it. They want it. They don't want to have to burn up a lot of time, which means a lot of money. And I get where that comes from, but a lot of times people just don't know, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what you said there, making sure you know how to reproduce the problem. And if it's something that takes several days, tell them that. Say, look, I know I'm going to need to leave my computer with you. Let me show you a couple of things, but I doubt we'll see the problem crop up here. You know, it needs to be left on for a couple of days, and then you'll start to see this and this happen. Mm-hmm.
Or another one. Yeah. So giving an expectation of, like you said, it could be heat related, so it may take a couple of hours. And
sure.
It may not in my case, it was easy enough for me to get it to the point where it would fail pretty much. I knew within 5 minutes that it would reproduce it, but a heat problem, another thing is maybe take a video. We actually had someone who had a rather involved booting issue, and they were like, well, I'm not quite sure how to, show you what's happening. I'm like, take a video when the machine's starting up.
Oh, that's a good idea.
The thing is, it actually helped us, Dave. So he's like, well, first I'm having trouble booting in verbose mode. And it's like, try this other way. And then he sent us a video. It was like several minutes long, but it had enough detail where we could see the various steps that it was taking during the boot process. And actually pointed out, in this case, that basically your boot drive was trashed.
You're right. Yeah, no, but that's right. Yeah. No.
So if you can video it or take a picture of it, doesn't have to be sometimes you can't take a screenshot. It's impossible.
No, but you take a picture of your phone. Movie. Yeah. No, that's right. Especially if you're seeing something weird on the screen that is hard to describe accurately. A lot of times, especially if it's like a graphics issue or something, if a technician who has seen this problem or lots of these problems many times before can simply see a picture of what you're experiencing, that can totally shortcut the process. They're like, oh, I know what that means. You know, those artifacts on the screen mean this problem. Whereas, yeah, anyway. All right. This is good. Send in your stuff. One more thing, John, before we go here, there was an article, and it was a mostly good article, actually, in 9to5 Mac this week about if you purchase your own cable modem, you'll save money, which is true. We've been talking about that recently here. And actually, I got another one I want to mention that I've been testing. But it also said that you would get faster download speeds. And this was true for the reviewer because they were using a very old cable modem that didn't support the speeds that their provider was currently sending them. However, purchasing a new cable modem was not the only path to fixing that problem. If this reviewer had simply gone to his or her cable, it was a he, I think. So if he had gone to his cable company and asked them to replace the modem he was renting with an updated modem, they would happily have done so. And then he would have gotten all of the speeds that he got with this modem that he purchased. I just wanted to point that out because this article was kind of being shared in a way that made it seem like your cable company would offer you these speeds that they wouldn't necessarily then deliver to you because your modem was old. And the only solution was buying one, not just having them, you know, update your rental. They will update your rental modem pretty much anytime you walk in the store. So just remember that if you're renting, or like in your case, John, you're not renting. You are, but you're forced to, in that there's no, you would save no money if you stopped using their modem and returned it to them. So,
right. Optimum does not offer, they'd be fine with me
sure
providing my own. But the thing is, it's built in, you know, and it's funny because, you know, some people, when you were discussing this in some venue, some people said, well, I don't pay a rental fee.
Right.
Like, for example, I don't. Well, right. I do in a sense. The thing is, it makes, I would get no advantage from
right
buying my own modem because they give it to me. And actually, in the case of like with my parents' recent upgrade where they were being pestered by Xfinity to upgrade, it worked.
Oh, sure.
Well, number one, they're paying, I assume, the same fee. But the thing
correct
is, they actually went from a DOCSIS 2 to a DOCSIS 3. So their speeds went from like 30 down to 90 down.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, right. But the cable company is not against you doing this. And again, they will help you. But that said, I still feel like if you were in the scenario where you are paying a modem rental fee, especially if you're on Comcast, you are now paying $10 a month. You can say you can make that money back real fast by buying your own modem, usually in less than a year, especially if you're just buying a regular modem and not a modem router combo kind of thing. You can get a really high quality modem for, you know, anywhere between 60 and 90 bucks. And you can do the math on how many months it takes to catch that up if you're paying 10 bucks a month. What I do want to talk about is another modem that I've been testing. You know, my house here is crazy, as you know, because we're always trying different things. But the goal is for the family not to notice. That's the trick. And when they notice, then I know that something's not working. So the good news, family didn't notice. The Aeris 6900, which is their cable modem and Wi-Fi router built together. And we've talked about a couple of these. If you need a new cable modem, and it's also time for a new Wi-Fi router, this can be a good way to go. It makes it so that you've got it all in one and your, you know, firmware updates actually come automatically from your cable company, which is interesting. So they're fully tested by the time you get them. It's a 1900, it's an AC 1900 router, which means that it's got, you know, full 802.11 AC speeds, and then also 2.4 gigahertz with multi-streams. It's got four Ethernet ports on it. The router is a fully capable AC 1900 router. It does beamforming. It's got all of it. It supports IPv4 and IPv6. And it's got, you know, it's a DOCSIS 3 modem, 16 channels down that it will bond. And four up. And the nice part is, even if your cable stream, even if, say, you only need an 8x4 modem, right, where 8 channels down and 4 up to get the speeds that you need, that's true of me here. I only need an 8 down because I'm only getting, you know, 100, and, well, it's rated at 150, so I get about 175. But it will, Comcast will bond up to 20 channels down if you have them, regardless of your service level. Doesn't mean that I get more speed provision to me, because the modem gets a profile that says, hey, this is how fast you're supposed to go. But having more streams bonded or more channels bonded means that if things get congested, I probably won't notice, or I will notice less, because I'm not just limited to the number of channels that I've got, you know, that are needed for the bare minimum to get my service. This thing's been great. You know, and it's really, really simple to set up. And that's one of the nice things about these combo modems, is when you put them together, you know, when you're doing it separately, you've got to sort out, you know, getting the modem and your router in sync with each other. And sometimes that means power cycling the modem or this. When it's a combo, you don't have to worry about it. You just run it. And it's got a couple of Ethernet ports. All right, sorry, it's got 4 Ethernet ports on it. It's got a couple of USB ports, so that you can, you know, hang a printer off of it, or a storage device if you want. So their UI is pretty good. Which is the reason I wanted to test this, because they're coming out with this product called RipCurrent. This is Aeris. They're the company that's been making cable modems for a long time. They were in partnership with Motorola for a while. They make the Surfboard brand of cable modem. It's all back under the Aeris label now. But Aeris is coming out with this thing called RipCurrent, which is very similar to what Eero's doing. And so I figured looking at the UI of this modem would sort of give us a peek into what RipCurrent's going to look like. And I think we're going to be happy about it. It uses RipCurrent uses Powerline to keep everything in sync, or it can. It kind of uses everything to keep everything in sync. So I'm looking forward to what they're doing with that, especially after looking at the UI of this. So keep your eye on Aeris for what they're doing. It's pretty interesting stuff, John. I think so. Anyway, that's, you know, I think that's enough, right? Any questions about that modem, John?
Enough is enough.
I think so. Yeah. Crazy.
No questions. Okay. I've recently dealt with similar.
Yeah.
Well, the Xfinity. I was able to, you know, log into it.
Right.
And fiddle with it.
Yeah. 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 It's good stuff. Can I do one thing, John? Can I pimp something I'm really proud of? My band Fling, we released a 5-song EP this week called Bovine Abduction.
EP? What's
yeah,
that?
It's because it's only 5 songs instead of, say, 10, which you would call an album. So it's extended play is where the EP
concept. Oh, instead
concept.
Of an LP.
Correct. Long play versus extended play. Yeah. So it's 5 songs. It is now on Apple Music and Spotify, and you can buy it direct on CD Baby. You can stream it from our website at flingrocks.com. I'd love to know what you think of it. And you can stream it for free at flingrocks.com, but if you've got Apple Music or Spotify, you can stream it there. I'll put a link in the show notes to all of those places, and I'd love to hear what you think. We had a lot of fun. All the logic questions that have come up lately, a lot of those have been driven, my experience with Logic has been driven by this recording process, and especially the mastering process. I learned so much about how to do that and actually found some great tools. So I really want to, but we'll talk more about that in a future episode. So love to hear what you think. What else do we got, John? You want to tell them something?
I know what I'm going to tell them, Dave. Feedback at MacGeekAb.com is where you would send an email if you have questions, tips, comments, cool stuff found, or whatever else. Just want to say hi.
Just want to say hi. I think you said feedback at MacGeekAb.com, John.
Yeah, well, if you do want to say hi, you could send an email to feedback at MacGeekAb.com.
That's what you said, yeah. You can find us on the phone, 224-888-GEEK. And John, Geek is?
4335.
That's right. And find us on Facebook. Great community over there. I say it almost every week. It's a great place to be. Go to MacGeekGab.com/Facebook. That'll redirect you there. Great stuff. Great folks. Constantly growing. Constant interaction there. I posted a really weird question at 1 a.m. the other day about a listener slash friend who needed a video card advice for a really old Mac Pro. And within 20 minutes, I had like not only an answer, but great answers that totally helped send this guy in the right direction. So there's always somebody available to help.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I saw that. Yeah, video cards and Macs. It's kind of a...
It's crazy.
Magic.
Yeah. I want to thank CacheFly, CacheFly.com, for providing all the bandwidth to get the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace, of course, all our sponsors. I want to thank, and that includes Gazelle at Gazelle.com, iMazing at iMazing.com, Smile at SmileSoftware.com, Squarespace at Squarespace.com/MGG, Otherworld Computing at MacSales.com, Barebones Software at Barebones.com, and of course our three sponsors from the show, Smile Software, which I already mentioned, PDF Pen 8, Casper at Casper.com/MGG, and Atlassian, makers of Bitbucket, Jira, and more at Atlassian.com. And of course, thanks to all of you. Thanks to our premium listeners, Tim and Bob, Anthony. Have a good week, folks. Spend your money wisely. Know that a week from tomorrow is Mac Geek Gab's 11th anniversary. And gosh, is there anything else we need to tell them, John?
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I guess we just leave it at that. Whoa! Don't get caught!
Made up.